Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello, I'm Andrew McDermott. Today I'm joined again by Paul Nelson, a senior fellow of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture, an adjunct faculty in the Master of Arts program in Science and Religion at Biola University. Nelson is a philosopher of biology who has been involved in the intelligent design debate internationally for three decades. Paul, welcome back.
Thanks again for having me. I really enjoy it.
Absolutely. So we're talking with you today about your recent trip to the Galapagos Islands. We've already had part one where we discussed your initial reactions, how amazing it was to see these animals right before you without being afraid of your presence. And I'm sure you'll get into some of the reasons for that as we move forward. In part one, you also said Darwin was right, which is a strange thing to hear from someone in your position, but you have ample reason to say it. Are you being deliberately provocative here?
Oh, sure. I'm trying to provoke thinking in listeners, and also, I hope, for those who will read the blog Evolution News and Views for the companion articles to these podcasts. But let me say why I think that statement is justified. In the great summing up chapter of The Origin of Species, chapter 14 in the first edition, Darwin wrote, "When we regard every production of nature as one which has a history," he says, "we will understand nature better." Actually, he puts it this way, "How far more interesting will the study of natural history become?" Exclamation point in the original. Now, in one sense, I disagree with that, and I'll explain why I disagree in just a moment. But let me first say why I agree with that. And here's an exercise, actually, that listeners can try for themselves. There are online searchable versions of William Paley's Natural Theology, the classic of English natural theology, the discipline of natural theology that flourished when Darwin was a young man. In fact, he said at Cambridge University, reading Paley's Natural Theology was the single text that was most valuable to him in his education. There was a lot of his education he thought that was a waste of time, but reading Paley, he said, was really valuable to him. And he was steeped in this way of thinking about living things, namely that they were the products of intelligence. Now, he came to reject that view, but much of Paley's understanding of nature made its way through to Darwin with one very important difference, a difference that ended up, I think, in the long run, leading to the theory of evolution. So here's the exercise that readers can perform with this online version of Paley. Open up the file in your browser, and because it's searchable, you can enter the term history. All right, so you enter the search term history and look for the hits that come up in that book. And I'll tell you what's not there. What's not there in Paley, and as much as I admire Paley, and I really do, there's almost no historical sense in the book Natural Theology. Even though we know that every living thing on this planet has a history, that perspective on living things is more or less entirely missing from Paley. So Darwin, as a young man, set sail on the Beagle. He goes to the Galapagos. He sees the things I talked about in the first episode, such as that the birds on those islands are remarkably tame. He said he could practically grab them by the legs, right, and catch them that way. They just had no fear of humans. Whereas the birds that he knew from England would give humans plenty of room. The difference that we observe there has got to be explained, and we explain it via the history of those species. The birds in England, who were not fearful of humans, ended up, probably many of them, being killed, right? They didn't leave offspring. Whereas the birds on the Galapagos, because they didn't really have any human predators, they were not affected in the same way by the presence of humans, and really sort of had to learn by being killed that humans were dangerous to them. So there's a difference there in the environmental circumstances and the history of those species that has consequences for what we observe. So when Darwin says every living thing has a history, he means something very important to biology that will never go away. So anyone listening to me today will acknowledge, yeah, I have a history, right? I wasn't spontaneously generated one fine morning. I had parents, my parents had parents, and there's a lineage that runs back in time that is relevant to explaining why I am as I am today, right? Every person listening to me has mutations in their DNA that were not there in their grandparents. They are new mutations that arose. That's history. So that matters to biological explanation.
Okay. So biological history, very important as we look at organisms and why they're here. So tell me, is this at odds with intelligent design, this historical perspective on life?
Not at all. Not at all. In fact, I would say that one of the irreversible aspects of the Darwinian revolution that already is, but will in the future will need to be incorporated in any theory of biological design, is understanding and separating the effects of design, that is, those things that were caused by intelligence, from what we might call the effects of history, where a new mutation arises in a population and ends up being fixed in that population, that there are features of living things that we would not necessarily assign to intelligent design, but we would say those are consequences of natural processes acting on that species, acting on that population. And this is irreversible in the sense of scientific history, that it's something that Darwin identified as important that wasn't there in Paley. And again, this listener can perform this exercise for himself or herself. It's really not there in the natural theology. This is a part of biological reality that intelligent design will incorporate and needs to incorporate in its own understanding and explanation of what we see. So that's an aspect of biology that I think we can properly credit to Darwin, while yet disagreeing with him about what that history really was. I said I would mention this, and I'll do it now. I think what Darwin did is to say, really, history is everything. Everything that we observe about living things is a consequence of natural process. And there, I think he got it wrong.
So I think what you're saying is that when we look at the history, it can help us separate the micro versus the macro evolutionary processes, the small scale change versus what people claim to be the large scale change.
That is actually a very helpful way of making this distinction. Many years ago, Ray Bolin, who is one of the fellows of Discovery Institute, published a book with a beautiful title. The title alone is pure gold. It's The Natural Limits to Biological Change. I think I have that right. Ray, please forgive me if I got it wrong. But what I love about that phrase, natural limits, is Ray put his finger on something very important, namely that while organisms do adapt, while they do change in response to environmental circumstances and other things, there are limits to what those changes can bring about. Those limits are discoverable, and it's in sifting the effects of what's caused by design versus the effects of so-called natural process, that biology, when it incorporates history and design, will be able to be most powerful in leading to new knowledge and leading to new understanding. So these twin aspects of biological reality, history and design, are both important for the science to go forward.
Can you talk about some of the signs of history that you saw on the islands, on the Galapagos?
When we were exploring one day on one of the islands, walking among hundreds of marine iguanas, black as coal, right? And they're out there sunning themselves before they go back in the water to feed again. They were as indifferent to us as if we had been a bunch of plants or trees or boulders. They just didn't care. That would not be the case for a lizard or an iguana on the continent. When I'm in warm climates here in the United States that have lizards, they see me, boom, they take off to hide, right? But another thing that struck me about the Galapagos were the number of species unique to that setting that we wouldn't find elsewhere, such as flightless cormorants. birds that are excellent swimmers and have stubby little wings that cannot fly, right? There's a history there. Again, any visitor to the Galapagos who has his eyes open is going to see these differences, and it will provoke his curiosity. What explains those differences, and what tools do I need to understand them?
So interesting. Well, what does intelligent design provide that a strictly historical perspective does not?
Well, you already touched on it in your comment about macro and micro. I think what we find as we look at the changes that we see both in natural and experimental populations, that there definitely are these limits that Ray Bolin talked about. They're discoverable. You can map them. And my own intuition that I think is supported by all kinds of evidence is that design gives an account of the basic form of the organism. So a cormorant that flies versus a cormorant that's flightless. So a Galapagos cormorant that has stubby little wings and spends its life in the water as a fisherman, and a flying cormorant that actually uses its wings, they share basic features that will be true of any cormorant, right? They've got a gut, they've got a brain, they've got a nervous system, they have feathers. Yet, between those two species, we observe differences in their behavior and in their anatomy that may well be explained by microevolutionary processes, the reduction of the wings and so forth, and sifting those differences with respect to their causes, the similarities and the differences, the basic major features of that bird are explained by design. And I think the evidence supports that. It's probably the case that some of the differences would be explained by microevolutionary processes. And that's where biological knowledge resides, in being able to discriminate the micro and the macro and take that knowledge and make predictions.
So important to look at the big picture then when you're formulating these theories.
Definitely.
Well, we're out of time again, but we will be back for one more episode with Paul, unpacking his experiences and insights from his recent trip to the famed Galapagos Islands. Catch other episodes of the podcast on the web at idthefuture.com or through your favorite podcasting platform. For now, for ID the Future, I'm Andrew McDermott. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.